heard that.
About the history of the U.S. taking over New Mexico. About Texas, I think, claimed that Rio Grande as its western border at one time, and then the U.S. claimed it before the war of 1848. So, what's the history
of it? Well, the United States, of course, started moving into Spanish territory even before was Mexico, you know, into Missouri, into Florida, and then the settlement, the settlers, the southern settlers who went into Texas and began getting grants. Mexico was, you know, I told you about this trade deficit that developed. They were a very poor country when they became independent. They were cut off then from any kind of subsidies from the mother country. And the United States immediately had, you know, under Jefferson, began looking at the territory as or the whole, when the United States became independent, you really have to go back to the Northwest Ordinance. They developed the Northwest Ordinance before the Constitution, and it laid out a plan for coast to coast. It was so that it's so such a plan. It's called Manifest Destiny, as a kind of description of it, that in our minds, I call it the Rorschach test of inherent imperialism, we think of, well, I do this to my students. I say, draw a map of the United States in 1776, and they immediately draw this continental shape. And then they go, you know, that's not right, you know, it's just 13 colonies, but in the Northwest Ordinance, they actually drew maps, rough maps, all the way, like in Portland, Maine, to Portland, Oregon. Each of those colonies that would become states would then control all the way across. They would be, you know, kind of their first idea were these very autonomous states. And each one would control all the way across. So the South, you know, in the South, from Virginia on over, and as they were conquering the South from the indigenous farmers there, Texas was, you know, their manifest destiny, they thought. So they began to move in there with slaves. Meanwhile, with the Santa Fe trade completely diverted to Missouri, the Mexican government lacked any kind of economic base to develop, and of course under Spain it had become quite feudal in this devolvement of the Spanish Empire, so that there were these large feudal estates, and Mexico was breaking up the estates and giving out land, but in fact it had no support. So they began selling land grants in Texas to these slave owners, and they came to own private property, you know, most of the arable property in Texas, and of course did their own little coup and claimed the territory. Mexico did not recognize the right of independent Texas or it being a state. So in 1846, when the United States invaded, they were claiming Texas, but Mexico didn't recognize that claim. So
they didn't have effective control over there either.
They didn't have effective control. So most of you, I think, know something about the war against Mexico, but it was an invasion. It was they invaded through Veracruz and took Mexico City, occupied Mexico City. The Mexican army was so devastated that they were the 13, 14-year-old school were actually going out and fighting the U.S. soldiers in the streets of Mexico City. That's why the heroes of the war are prominent, you know, statues, these little boys, the children who died fighting the American soldiers. So they were holding Mexico City, and they negotiated this Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo of 1848 to transfer the northern half of Mexico to the United States. What is amazing about that treaty and the proceedings is how the Mexican negotiators, government, were so insistent on the protection of the citizens of Mexico in the territory. They knew they had no choice but to let it be annexed. They were not interested in the money payment. It was so minuscule. What they did in negotiate and insist upon was the protection of the citizens' rights, and they were mainly thinking about New Mexico because that was the most densely populated place. And they negotiated, you know, that Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo is a very important instrument for the Mexican, former Mexican citizens on the border. It's very important to understand, you know, the current so-called immigration issue, the cross-border issue. And everyone in Mexico knows that. They know that treaty. In the United States, most people haven't even read it. You know, you find it on the internet. It's easy to find. It guarantees, for instance, all property to be respected by the United States. All property as it is, its holders, as if these people were U.S. citizens. And so the taking of the commons, for instance, was completely against the treaty. Also, in property law in the United States, there have been decisions that that, you know, property goes further than real estate, such as language. And there was a Supreme Court case that was brought by a Chinese case. The reason why we have bilingual ballots, even if you have English first in a state, you can't do away with this, you know, Supreme Court decision that said that all federal documents had to be in trials. You know, there has to the mother language is a right. Up until for many, many years in New Mexico and California, there was bilingual, everything was printed in Spanish and English. And that should be today as well. You know, under that treaty, the same rights as Quebec has under the Canadian Constitution, or that the Walloons have in Belgium. So that treaty that was negotiated, it really is amazing when you read it, how under the gun the Mexican negotiators really did get a strong treaty. And it was no gift from the United States. They just could not get them to sign that treaty until they guaranteed the property rights and many other rights. Also the right of return, that any of the citizens in the annexed territory who wanted to go into Mexico and remain Mexican citizens, that the Mexican government provided for it, that they would support them, help them move and find them a place to live. I discovered a scholar in New Mexico this time, an independent scholar, not an academic, who is doing research on these. He's found there are around 3,000 families that went back, and no one has ever traced them, you know, to find them. So he's doing that work to try to locate and find the descendants of those who went into Mexico, that transferred into Mexico. But the U.S. Invasion was brutal. I went to Las Vegas for the first time, Las Vegas, New Mexico, where Tierney, the Army of the West, under General Tierney, first pronounced this, you know, New Mexico belongs to the United States. States now. And in 1847, of course, there was plenty of resistance to that, but in Las Vegas, there's a plaque, you know, where he made his proclamation. And it was a very, very racist little speech he made. It's there in the park, you know, it's a historical monument. But he then, of course, went straight for Taos, which is, you know, the market center, which is Taos Village, not Taos Pueblo. And the Taos Pueblo people, along with Geniceros and a lot of the other villages around, they formed an army, a resistance army, and held off the conquest of Taos for weeks. And it was funny because when they captured the Taos Pueblo leader, Tomasico, they found him guilty to be hung for treason against the United States. It's such an odd way of thinking, you know. I mean, maybe murder, maybe this, that treason against the United States. And so he and many others were hung. So that was in 1847, that revolt. So they didn't have an easy time, you know, of the conquest, and resistance continued. There were the, also the 19th century, the Gordas Blancas, the white, what was that translated, the white...
Fat.
Huh?
The white fat men? Gordas Blancas?
No, not Gordas. But they were masked Zorro types, you know, who cut the fences of the farmers who came in, the Anglo farmers. You know, there were wars in New Mexico. You mainly know about it through Billy the Kid stories, but there were wars between the sheep herders and the cattlemen. The Mexicans were the shepherds and the Pueblos. They couldn't afford cattle, and the Anglos brought cattle in. And it was, you know, the Santa Fe Trail and the Chisholm Trail, that was the market. You know, they were taking the, when Kansas, you know, Kansas City stockyards were developed, that they were on hoof, you know, taking all of these cattle and then taking them on to Chicago and exporting beef around the world. And so you had the wars between the Mexican shepherds, sheep herders, and the Anglo cattlemen. Billy the Kid. You also had wars between the cattlemen, different cattlemen, and then the Pueblo Indians who were. Everyone was losing their land. So the Pueblo Indians sued the United States for Indian status. They were citizens of Mexico. They had been made citizens, although they had autonomy. The Mexican government had come in and tried to allot all of the land, and both the Geniceros and the Pueblos revolted in 1837 against that, so they were granted autonomous lands, but they were had full citizenship rights. And I think the Mexican period, you know, it's usually just not even mentioned in any history books, even in New Mexico history, because it was 24 years. But I think it must have been very exciting for people to go from being under this rigid theocracy of the Spanish Empire to the Mexican government coming in and doing away with the church, you know, making it a secular state, sending the Franciscans back to Spain, requiring under their first constitution that all priests be native born, and what that meant was, you know, priests. They hadn't bothered to train any native priests. So there were no priests at all. That happened in Cuba in 1959. They said only native born priests can stay, and you know, everyone had to leave. So I think it must have been very exciting, you know, to have a sense of freedom. The Pueblos, up until Mexico was independent, could not leave their Pueblos without a pass. They weren't allowed to ride horses. You know, it's that kind of oppression. So I think something very precious was lost, you know, with the U.S. conquest for the people there and the process that was taking place. Yeah, they would have had a harder time, you know, being a part of a third world country, basically Mexico, on the, you know, on the border with the richest capitalist country in the world. But the processes they would go through, and of course that border would have been in a very different place.
Yeah, let's kind of make some comments here, because at that time, the United States of America was not the richest capitalist country in the world. I think England was. And you had.
No, I'm talking about the president.
In those days, you see, it was quite things were quite different. And also, you mentioned Mexico.
It was the richest country in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, Mexico was a major producer of silver at that time.
Which was all going into the U.S. Treasury.
Well, before that, it went all the way to the Spanish Treasury. In other words, Mexico was subsidized to Spain rather than the other way around.
This is, well, you know, the story of the currency is very interesting,
yeah.
Because one of the things that happened with the Santa Fe trade was that all of that currency, the silver, they dealt only in silver, was going into the U.S. Treasury, and was the single most important income generating was taking that trade, because they didn't take the trade, but they took the silver as well. And they actually depleted the Mexican store of silver currency.
The communities that you originally became interested in, those were the Anisteros?
Anisteros, yeah.
Anisteros that were given land by the Spanish?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what is the status of this now?
Well, these villages, they're about 150 villages that once were part of, like I said, these large land grants that included the commons. I didn't finish explaining that what they did with these with the commons. 40% of all of the land in New Mexico is owned by the federal government under various agencies, the National Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service, the National Park Service, and the Bureau of Land Management, military bases, Los Alamos. So 40%, in fact, all of the communal land grant property, the commons that were denied, are now owned, not by private landowners, but by the federal government. And so to restore that land to the people would just take an executive order, not even an act of Congress, to restore, you know, to make good the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, simply to restore it. So that, you know, it is the intention of the requirement of capitalism to not allow people to be self-sufficient, you know, or sufficient in food and farming, and most of us kind of accept that as a as forever, as if that's inevitable now. But it's not necessarily so. You know, I mean, if we think about how are we going to decapitalize, you know, replace capitalism, we've mostly thought of a system of a kind of leaving things as they are with a socialization. And I think, you know, my experience in New Mexico, and I think also, you know, growing up among the landless who why I think it's so important to, you know, the whole of the world, not just the United States. Yes?
I have a question about water. You described 98 wetlands.
Right.
And it almost seems to be, and then also the irrigation system that they had that was destroyed by the Trump sewers, of course.
Well, it still exists. It was just damaged.
Yeah. How much does that correlate with the Colorado River and that system that was essentially stolen not only from the indigenous people of the United States, who were in the United States, but also Mexico? I mean, it's nothing. There's nothing there in bottom. No.
Right. Yeah, it's completely out of control. You know, the whole system of water distribution. You know, in New Mexico along the Rio Grande, which is, I mean, most of us think of the Rio Grande as, you know, Texas, South Texas, but the northern Rio Grande goes up. And the tributaries that go out from it, or the tributaries that can be created through irrigation, you know, from supports a, you know, a huge, can support a huge population with food. And they had water wars always. You know, there's always in an air, we're in dry land with irrigation, there's always upstream and downstream conflict. And generally they solve things by diplomacy, you know, working things out. But the upstream users always have the upper hand, you know. And with the United States, there's just no sensibility at all of any kind of sharing. It's just hoarding. So like you say, when you get down on the Colorado River, Mexico, it's dry bed. You know, they're not getting any water. They're starved for water. And they don't have a lot of water in Mexico. So this has gotten worse and worse in the 20th and 21st century. In the 19th century, they still had, you know, had the use of that water. Yes, and the, you know, one of the things that the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, another thing is they did kind of acknowledge, and it became a tradition, of applying some of the Spanish-Mexican laws. For instance, those of us in California take for granted that our beaches can't be privately owned. You know, I loved it when I lived in LA and I go to Malibu and just taunt the whole rich crowd. You could go right up to their patio and hide. Because you can't own the beaches. Now they hate it. Back east, you know, or in Florida, all these places, people own the beaches. I couldn't believe it when I went back east and they had private property, a beach, you can own the beach. Well, that's the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. That's why we have public beaches. Because the, you know, the beaches cannot be owned, the waterfronts can't be owned, the resources can't be owned, and the water. So the session area is under different water laws than the, it's under the riparian rather than the English, you know, use it or lose it, English common law. And that they try everything they can through court decisions, and I expect this Supreme Court will find, you know, will find more and more loss of water for small users. And it especially affects the Pueblo Indians. They don't fall, there is a protection of Indian water rights from some decisions of, you know, the Indian Trust. And that was a decision in Washington State back in the 1960s of the rights to water, not just the, you know, not just rivers, but the use of the lakes and streams for salmon, and it was really about salmon fishing. and Indian water rights that applies to all Indians, because the way the U.S. government Indian policy works is like one size fits all. Well, in the case of the water rights, that's very advantageous to the Indians. But because the Pueblo Indians didn't become Indians until 1916 through a Supreme Court decision, they had to sue for Indian status not to lose their land. They don't come under the Indian water law. So they're having to depend on the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo for, you know, their water rights. And so it's very complicated, the water situation in a desert area. And what we're finding, you know, is there are water wars going on all over the world, you know, for water is not a renewable resource. You know, all of these aquifers are getting used up, and it takes millions of years, you know, to replace them. They've been overused. And the one in that area is the Oglala, you know, aquifer, and it is dangerously low because of the industrial use. There should not be any industry in that area. You know, it just should not be. And only small-scale irrigation works. It's just ridiculous. And it's California, you know, to be the biggest rice producer in the world, a desert, you know, does that make sense to anyone? I mean, let Southeast Asia be the biggest rice producer as it used to be. We export rice to Vietnam now. We export corn to Mexico, the center of corn culture.
What is the difference in status between the Pueblo indigenous population of New Mexico and the Fenisa?
Well, like I say, the best definition of Fenisa is detribalized Indians. They were their mixture of the Indians who were already detribalized, who had been captured as slaves. Indian slavery was the first slavery in the Americas, you know, even before African slaves were brought, they were enslaving. They outlawed Indian slavery formally in the laws of the Indies in 1588, but the practice continued through other means like repartimiento and the encomienda, where if you took the land, you got the Indians with it, you know, and they couldn't leave. So it was a chattel slavery. But the first century of Spanish conquest, there was, and once people were in slavery, Indian slavery, they inherited the status. And whole parts of Central America were depopulated, the western part of Nicaragua and Honduras. All those Indians, Nahuatl-speaking Indians, were transferred to the mines of Peru. So they brought these Mexican Indians from different communities as, you know, they enslaved them. And they brought them, first they were in Zacatecas. The conquerors of New Mexico were Basque families in Zacatecas. And they all had their own slaves. They were wealthy, already wealthy families who decided to do this colonizing. You know, they had to apply for it. It had to be approved by the king of Castile and Aragon. And then they brought the slaves with them. By that time, they were also Africans. And so these were people brought in who already spoke Spanish, only Spanish, and had been made at least formally Catholics, but they were Indians or Africans. There may have been some miscegenation, you'd have to call it that, because there's certainly not intermarriage at that time. The Spanish had a very strict caste system of these 32 degrees you know, with Indians at the bottom in the Americas. Even African was above the Indian, only slightly, and then Zambo, the combination of Indian and African, was next lowest to any Indian. But then, you know, it would make a jump if the father was European and the mother was Indian. That jumped the caste up pretty high to mestizo. But the Janiceros were not really in the mestizo class. They were down lower, you know, in the New Mexico interpretation of the caste system. There was almost no intermarriage between the Basque families. And you can see it, the elite in New Mexico are very, you know, blue-eyed, often blondes, very European-looking people. And they stayed pretty pure, you know, and they sent back to the old country, you know, to get wives or whatever. So they stayed pretty pure. There wasn't much mixture. But the Janicero class kept growing because they kept, they made war constantly against the Navajos, Apaches, and Utes, who fought on the frontier and would not let the Spanish expand into their territories. So every war captive they took, they made a servant. And generally they would raid camps of women and children, simply take people out. They also, in any uprising of the Pueblos, they would take captives. And then another group of people who became Janiceros would be Pueblos who converted to Christianity and were no longer welcome in the Pueblo because of that, and were asked to leave. Where did they go? Where could they go? They became servants and, you know, went to the body of the... So it was a collection of genetically, if you took DNA of any of these descendants, they would be almost pure Indian. But culturally, they speak Spanish and they have their own form of Catholicism. It's called penitente. You know, it's a very different Catholicism because they often didn't have priests or didn't have missionaries in these little towns. There weren't enough to go around, so they sort of reinvented the religion, reading the Bible and, you know, just also creating. There's a whole art form of the saints that they design and make the small saints that are, you know, just unique, and they sell for like $1 million at Sotheby's, you know, the old ones and everything. But it's really a unique, I mean, you know, Catholicism has its manifestations in it, like the Virgin of Guadalupe in Mexico. I don't know if you saw the picture that was all over the press today. I saw several papers of the visitation on this day of the to the monument of the Virgin of Guadalupe in Mexico City. But it's Clown's Day, and everyone goes dressed as a clown. You know, the babies, the children, the people, everyone is dressed as a clown. Well, that, I've never seen that in any other Catholic. You know, so they recreated, but it's very different from the Pueblos. Now, the Pueblos have a kind of dual system that they've maintained, this sort of outward system where they'll go to the Catholic, you know, they have a Catholic mission, they will go there. But they practice their religion in the kivas very secretively because they kind of went underground, literally underground with their religion, and that's how they maintained it. The Janiceros don't have those practices. So there's this divergence. They really have developed as a new people, you know, a unique people. They have talked about, some of them, of filing with the federal government, with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to receive designation as Indians. And I think they would have a pretty good chance of getting it. I think the Pueblo Indians would probably oppose it, but they certainly are unique. They're not, you can't really say they're Hispanos or Hispanic. They're closer to, you know, in their practices, in their communal use of property, their village system of sharing and all, really closer to the Indian.
They are the, that's the group that would be the migrant at some point.
Right.
So the Spanish as a whole group to allow them to sustain themselves.
Right.
Are they still, are the majority of this original population still farming in the areas where these migrants were given, even though they cannot use the commons?
Well, they try to, and a few people hang on. But generally they can't make a living, and the young people leave. The older people stay, and then the young people bring their kids there. They keep the culture. But you know, this is also true of Indians. They can't make a living on the reservation, so they leave. They live in the cities, but they come back. They maintain a very close relationship. They know where they come from. For instance, Dolores Huerta is, you know, from a land grant outside of Las Vegas in that, you know, that kind of mountain area, Janicero land grant. And I heard when I was there that she always comes back, you know, and that she's thinking of moving back, resettling.
Can they dominate their land? Do they own it?
The little pieces of land that they own in the land grant, they can't, without permission of the other families, sell it. They have to sell it to the other families. But what's happened with some of these towns, you know, it's become very sexy to live in New Mexico. You know, a long time ago, Dee Flores and Mabel Dodge and Mabel Dodge married a Pueblo Indian, and Mabel Dodge Lujan, and then Georgia O'Keeffe went down. Well, in the 70s and 80s, a whole new influx of people, I think from that movie, what was it called, the Peter Fonda movie, The Motorcycle?
Easy Rider.
You know, where they have dinner with the family there, and they talk a little bit, and, you know, the hippies started coming in to New Mexico after that, and then Peter Fonda bought a ranch, and then Jane Fonda bought a ranch, and now Shirley MacLaine has a ranch, and even Donald Rumsfeld has a ranch outside of his house. And now the CIA lady who's named Valerie Plame and her husband Joe Wilson, they have a ranch. They all put on fringed, you know, Neil Young fringed jackets. And they get down there. We're silver belts. Anyway, they completely taken over Santa Fe and Taos. Misuse the water, and of course then they have to have golf courses, and they have to have, you know, other, so it's really a problem. And so many people can only make money, they're the Pueblos and the Janiceros villagers, off their arts and crafts, and they're dependent then on these rich people. And some of the Janicero villages like Chimayo are just, you know, there are these resorts and bed and breakfasts, and, you know, for spas, and there are hot springs down there too, so the Hema Springs. And so it's you know, people have loved New Mexico too much. You know, people ask me, they're like, why don't you come back and live here? I said, I don't want to be associated with them. I'd be called, you know, a Anglo exploiter, you know, if I come here. And I said, no, there are exceptions, but it's really a huge problem in New Mexico. And especially in the most traditional areas. And it's eroding, you know, it's another phase of erosion. And also, you know, the land grant struggle, like I said, it's kind of gotten hijacked by this ruling elite of Hispanos who want to bring in more development and, you know, more for New Mexico to be more in the mainstream of the United States.
Yeah, could you explain that a little bit more? Because, you know, my acquaintance with the Alianza movement was that it was, you know, a pretty radical movement. Take over some buildings and so forth, take right. over of land, occupations. And what was what happened to where that movement was co-opted by the elites? You know, how did that happen? Because I know it was some very militant people, a lot of militant Chicanos that were involved with that, and just what happened there?
Well, you know, this has largely happened since I, you know, published the book first in 1980. So I spent the last couple of years investigating just that question, what has happened? Because a lot of clashes have developed, culture clashes, that in the first version of my book, and still in this one, I show, you know, the pueblos and the caniceros coming closer and closer together. The pueblos made a film that was broadcast nationwide on PBS in 1992, the 500-year anniversary of Columbus, the quincentenary. It's kind of an anti-quincentenary movie called Before Columbus. And in it, they included the Janicero villages as indigenous villages. And they had, you know, spokespeople. That was just so encouraging. It was what my book was all about, is these people have an interest in common. And these are tribalized Indians who did get land. And it's not really theft of land from, you know, from the pueblos. And that's different from the private land rents. Well, since 1992 to the present, and that's only 15 years, some drastic things have happened. And I do think, you know, Bill Richardson plays a part in this. This elite class, first of all, had a reaction against the coming out, you might say, of the Pueblos and openly celebrating in 1980 the Pueblo Revolt. It was the first time that, you know, publicly celebrated it. They have always had this upper class Hispanic elite. They have always had their parades on the anniversary of Oñate, de Vargas, the second conqueror, who came in 1692, the reconquest. And they call it the reentrada, you know, the re-entrance, and say it was peaceful and everything. And they reenact it in Santa Fe and put on the costumes and all. And the Pueblos kind of ignore this. You know, it's like, okay, this little, you know, little parade that no one pays much attention to. But in 1992, it was the 400 years anniversary of 300 year anniversary of de Vargas coming in, you know, because that was in 1692. So it was the 300 years. So the celebration that year, I think it was a backlash to the huge indigenous movement that built up in the anti-quincentenary. Do not celebrate Columbus. You know, this was a huge thing that gave birth to an enormous international indigenous movement that made real changes. I mean, Evo Morales was a part of this, as a very young man, you know, opposing the quincentenary. So Spain was in, and the Vatican were insistent on making huge celebrations of this bringing civilization to the Americas. They literally put it that way and put huge amounts of money into it. And of course, the Reagan administration in the 80s put lots of money into the quincentenary. And so I think that even though the Pueblos had never before protested the de Vargas celebration, they did that year because they had gotten activated. And I think this was seen as a kind of breakdown of the status quo, you know, that we do our thing, you do your thing, and we won't argue with each other. And by that time, it was pretty clear, you know, that the Chicano, the younger generation, had grown up with the consciousness of the Chicano movement, which was very strongly allied with the American Indian movement. And the American Indian movement itself was pretty crushed, you know, by COINTELPRO and really smashed. I mean, it still existed in name, but it didn't have a coherence. So there was a kind of vacuum there. And I think they then just ran with it and said, now we're going to have Hispano pride, and we're going to teach this in the schools. And so by 1998, which was then the anniversary of Oñate, the first conqueror, who was so bad, such a genocidal criminal, that he was arrested and carried in chains back to Spain at the time for his brutality. It's not that, you know, the Indians would say he was brutal. He was too brutal even for the Spanish Empire. And, you know, the priest had complained he's causing trouble because he's just murdering, he's dismembering, he does it with his own hands, he's bloodthirsty, he's corrupt. They decided to celebrate this man. They had never celebrated before. So they got through by that time, you know, all through the 90s, Phil Richardson played a big role in putting a lot of funds into this class of people. Because this was his constituency. He's not really, he's not from New Mexico. He's from a very wealthy North American businessman who married into a very wealthy Mexican family. And he grew up mainly in Mexico City and Dallas, I think, or, you know, some city in the north. So he was an import, and that usually doesn't work very well in New Mexico. So this was, I think a part of it was his building up this constituency to then support him politically. And that ties into it. But they started commissioning all these statues of Oñate. And the statues got bigger and bigger until last year, the largest equestrian statue in the world was placed in the El Paso airport. Because that's where Oñate came in, you know, that's called El Paso the Pass, where they came into how they conquered Mexico. So the Pueblos are incensed, you know, at this celebration. They could take de Vargas, okay, we won't say anything, you know, too bad about de Vargas. You guys can have him. Pueblos are pretty patient people. But Oñate, that's too much. And if you look at the cover of my book, it's a Pueblo Indian painting of the Oñate's massacre of the people at Acoma Pueblo up on Sky City. It's just killed probably 3,500 people, almost wiped them out, captured 300, and there were no women and children left. The men and boys that they captured, the sentence was to cut off the right foot of each of them as punishment. And so that depicts the dismemberment of it. So it was a very, very cruel. So especially Acoma Pueblo, which took it's the lowest, you know, most southern, took the brunt of the Oñate conquest. So I think, you know, the combination of those factors that have written, and maybe, you know, it's healthy in some ways because the Pueblos have kind of kept to themselves and just hunkered down and tried to survive. And now they're coming out and saying things that the Hispanos have never heard them say, you know, because they didn't say them publicly before. But there's quite a strong clash now, and I think even more my book is important because it does make that class analysis, you know, that has a, it's not just an ethnic question, it's also a class issue, you know, that that is predominant and important.
To what extent do you think the explosion of Indian gambling casinos is benefiting the Native American people?
Well, it depends on where. In New Mexico, it's not just benefiting the Indians, but, you know, the whole economy. They generally have, you know, as part of this New Mexico being so sexy, but generally the casinos are resort casinos. And they already had, you know, quite a lot of gambling in New Mexico that wasn't Indian related. They had dog races, for instance, which doesn't exist in many places, and all horse racing and stuff that were legal. It has really, really benefited. Not all the Pueblos have casinos. It's not it's not very lucrative, you know, unless you're on the highway or near the highway. Acoma does have on I-40. Acoma and Laguna have casinos. It has greatly improved. You know, they put it back into developing transportation system, jobs, it provides jobs. It's mixed back east. You know, the really, really big ones are, I don't know as much about, and I know there are very small groups of Indians who have only recently gotten acknowledgement as Indian tribes. In California, it varies. It varies how they make the pacts with the states. And California, it's done well for those who have them. And they provide part of their profits to the non-gaming tribes, but it creates quite a differential, you know, between the standard of living between the gaming and non-gaming tribes. So it's a mixed bag. I feel like, you know, if you're going to do economic development and you think of capitalism and the environment and everything, really gambling is one of the least harmful capitalist enterprises around. It just pollutes the water, like Silicon Valley, you know, and all the chemicals. And so I don't feel very, I mean, would it be better to have a meat packing plant, you know, or a chemical plant, or, you know, a nuclear dump? I would rather see the gambling. So I think it's hard for people to get used to Indians being prosperous, that they sort of don't understand that the real issue is Indian sovereignty and not poverty, and that, you know, they're colonized and they want to get out of that and be able to restore their the integrity of their cultures. I work with a group of young Navajos who are trying to develop. They're very inspired by Bolivia and have decided to try to develop an alternative to capitalism and are developing a project of indigenous socialism. You know, how to, Navajo Nation is the biggest in territory and population. It's almost 1 million people now. And, you know, a huge, rich territory. So that would be really significant, you know, if they develop. They do, they, so far they don't have they haven't gone for gaming. And they want to go in a different direction, so they may provide a new model, not just for other Indians, but other communities that are forming local socialism.
Have they used any of their profits to any significant extent in developing programs, social service programs?
That's mainly what they do with it.
Yeah.
They couldn't, the way Indians operate, they couldn't get by without doing that. They would be in trouble. factions. And factions have developed, like the Mohawk. The Mohawks up on the Canadian-New York border are very divided about gaming. There's a traditional group who want nothing to do with gaming. And that goes back even to the liquor and cigarette sales, you know, that proceeded because of the tax-free status. Other people, like myself, my main fear of gambling or even the, you know, tax-free goods is if that's, you know, the main manifestation of sovereignty, of governmental sovereignty, that it doesn't win that many friends in the general population. That it's you know, it's seen as more pecuniary, you know, and less productive. And so I think, you know, a lot of the traditionals feel that it's not the best way to go. So there are divisions in the native population, you know, about this, and arguments within families. You know, it's an interesting discussion. I think it has really led to this. Well, let's look at an alternative and this idea of indigenous socialism and how that might work. So there's some really a lot of interesting thinking going on. But one thing it's produced, you know, is it's been going on for about 20 years now, the gaming, and there's the education in particular, educating the level of education and that has developed is just it's making all kinds of changes. And these young people who are thinking of indigenous socialism are kind of children of gaming-funded education. It's an interesting contradiction. Well, I better let you all go. I could talk to you all night. I really thank you for coming. And you can find my book on the web. You know, go to my website. RedDirtSite.com, RedDirtSite.com, and it will lead you how to order it from University of Oklahoma Press. Or get it, or have your bookstore order it, and then get it in the bookstore. Don't order it from your bookstore.